and welcome to the as yet unnamed London Theatre Podcast for the 15th of November 2015. My name's T.R.P. Watson, and this week I'm joined by Gareth James, Nick from Past the Obstructed View, and Julie Raby. We're now going to talk about Harlequinade, and possibly All on Her Own, which is a pair of plays put together by the Kenneth Branagh Company for their season at the Garrick. All on Her Own is a short play performed by Zoe Wanamaker. It's put in because Harlequinade, the more major play with a larger cast, including Kenneth Branagh and Miranda Rageson and other members of the cast from A Winter's Tale. But Harlequinade is usually paired with the Browning version, although I have heard that it's been less fashionable to put it with the Browning version because the Browning version is considered a very great Terence Rattigan play, and Harlequinade is thought of as, well, one of his lesser comedies, and people don't think too much of his comedies. Gareth, tell me more about this play and what you thought of it.
Well, as you say, it's normally paired with a Browning version, but they don't really go together. I presume he only wrote them to be played together because it would fill an evening. There's no other connection between them. So breaking the two up is not a big issue, although it does make for a less substantial evening, because in this case it's paired with a 25-minute monologue, which was written for television. It was a BBC TV commission, and I don't think it's been put on stage before. And that's the problem for the evening for me, is that it's not really very substantial enough for, you know, a West End night out, the launch of a new company by such a famous actor, and indeed West End prices as well. I'm a big Rattigan fan, but despite that, this isn't particularly good Rattigan. It's about a company, a theatre company, which is rehearsing Romeo and Juliet for a tour, which is being put on by the newly formed CIMA, which was actually the precursor to the Arts Council. And the actor-manager, who's called Gosport, is playing Romeo, and of course he's way over the age of Romeo, and his wife Edna is playing Juliet, and she's over the age of Juliet, but not quite so well over the age of Juliet as he is over Romeo. And the rest of the cast of this theatre company are either all pros, or indeed, you know, newbies trying to make their mark, really. And we're at the first venue on the tour up in the north, and the last time Gosport came here was quite some time ago, 20 or so years ago, and something that happened there and a relationship that he had then comes back to haunt him, and that's the main theme of the play, really, when he's visited by someone. There are some kind of quite clever things about putting it on. I mean, for kickoff, you know, this is Branagh launching his actor-manager theatre company, and this is a play about an actor-manager theatre company. It's quite good because it's in pairing with The Winter's Tale, so, you know, it's a theatre company doing a Shakespeare about a theatre company doing a Shakespeare. And indeed, there's a great company feel to the whole evening. You know, you get a real sense that this is a company that's having fun together. And in another clever little bit as well, Rattigan actually had a small part in the university production of Romeo and Juliet, which was in fact directed by John Gielgud. And the character he played in that, in here, is having exactly the same problems with the line that Rattigan had. So there's all sorts of quite nice little connections here, but, you know, that isn't really enough to warrant the evening, really. It's all perfectly well done. I mean, it's frankly a stellar cast. You know, in addition to Kenneth Branagh and Miranda Rayson as the theatrical couple, and they are great together, I have to say. There's some lovely other performances. You know, we've got Zoe Wanamaker, who shines as a kind of theatrical dame, which, given that she's yet to become a dame, I thought was also quite clever. And then you've got Tom Bateman, who's really, really good as the company manager, Jack Wakefield. And then you've got people like John Shrapnel, who turn up in really small roles. So it's a very good theatre company, and I look forward to seeing other things they're doing, although I'm not going to be able to get to Winter's Tale by all of it. And, you know, it's perfectly well staged, which is not a very substantial evening. And I don't think adding in All on Her Own is enough to make it that. I mean, it's a very interesting monologue. It's quite quirky. It's about a woman who comes home from a party where she's met a woman who's a fellow widow, as it were, who talks to her husband at the same time every evening that he died, and then she starts heavily drinking and indeed is either talking to or channeling her husband. And Zoe Wanamaker performs it really well, but it's a kind of, again, a very slight piece and a very quirky piece, and it forms, you know, the curtain raiser for this show, as indeed this show performs the curtain raiser for the whole theatre company. So, you know, an okay evening, but not really, doesn't really add up to the launch of a big venture like this for me.
Thinking about it, I would actually quite like to have seen Kenneth Branagh doing the Browning version. It would have been a really quite interesting piece, I think, to see him do Crocker Harris in that. So it's a slight pity that we're not getting that. But I thought Zoe Wanamaker was very powerful in All on Her Own, and I thought it was, you know, in its own way, a very clever and interesting piece of drama. As you say, though, Harlequinade, I mean, it's a confection. It's supposed to be silly. I think everybody took it to heart. It's not very substantial. I have, of course, seen The Winter's Tale, and I think The Winter's Tale does set off the season properly. But this is a bit of an odd choice. I mean, it does show at least that Kenneth Branagh has a sense of humour and can do comedy and can make fun of himself, because obviously there is quite a lot about being the ageing leading man that he's going to have to cope with in this, although I don't think he's doing... I mean, he is doing Romeo and Juliet later, but I don't think he's anybody substantial in it unless he's playing Friar Lawrence. It is very sort of light and fluffy and a bit silly, and they're all sending themselves up. I think everybody in the audience had a good time when I was there, and certainly it's been very well received by the critics. So I can see what you mean, because it is insubstantial. You do feel that you haven't quite seen enough of anything on seeing this play, but it was, people did have fun. But obviously, you know, that fun at West End prices, it has to be a lot of fun, and I don't think this is particularly that much fun. It is just too insubstantial, too self-referential, and to really make you think it's of value. But it's I mean, certainly the Kenneth Branagh company, it's an interesting thing. A lot of people think it's a bit of self-conceit, but I'm not sure. I mean, I quite like to see this idea we've had in the West End, you know, with people like Michael Grandage, where somebody comes in and tries to present a season of plays under a single-minded management, shall we say, not necessarily a single person, but somebody coming in and saying, look, we're going to put these plays on in rep with pretty much the same cast or a similar cast throughout, and trying to make a success of it. And I sort of applaud the ambition, but I'm not sure it always works properly.
Quite a risky selection. I mean, you know, Winter's Tale isn't everybody's favourite Shakespeare, and probably the only reason it's sold out is it does have Kenneth Branagh and Judi Dench in it. And then you've got Romeo and Juliet with no real names, except the quirky casting of Derek Jacobi in a role that's... Well, he's way beyond the age of the role, I think, isn't he? And then you've got a play that didn't do terribly well in Belfast, with him and Rob Brydon, The Painkiller. The only one that's obvious for me is The Entertainer, because I think Branagh is made to do The Entertainer, and I think that's a very exciting prospect. But it's a kind of quirky, odd sort of collection of things to do. But I do wish him well, because, I mean, as you say, I mean, as an actor, I mean, I'd forgotten, frankly, how good a comic actor he was, because, I mean, he was very, very funny in this, and it was very, very, you know, he was very, very good in that. As far as the play's concerned, I think, I mean, I have seen it before with the Browning version many, many years ago, and I frankly just couldn't remember anything about it, which probably tells you something about how insubstantial it is. And of course, we've seen the Browning version quite recently without Harlequinade as well, because we saw the Chichester production where they paired it with a new David Hare play set in a public school in South Downs, called South Downs. I also last week saw French Without Tears, Ratigan's first big success that I'd never seen before, and I know you talked about it on the podcast a while back, but I also took against that because I felt that had dated. I didn't think this play had dated in quite the same way, but I felt that play had dated, and I really just irritated me, to be honest. So I kind of come to the conclusion that Ratigan is a good, serious playwright, but maybe not a good comic playwright. And I think seeing the two in a week kind of focused my mind on that, really. And when I look back at all the things I'd seen by him, it just kind of dawned on me that I hadn't really liked the comedies, but I really had liked, you know, the dramas. And I think Harlequinade maybe just is another example of Ratigan outside his comfort zone, maybe.
We're now going to talk about Husbands and Sons, which is on at the National Theatre, in a co-production with the Royal Exchange Theatre in Manchester. This is a conflation of three of D.H. Lawrence's plays made by Ben Power and the director Marion Elliott. It's been designed by Bunny Christie with a very simple and spare set. Essentially, we are in a mining town in Nottinghamshire, which is a fictionalised version of the place that D.H. Lawrence grew up. And the play imagines that you are in three almost back-to-back houses, or at least closely spaced houses. Now, the set, therefore, really just has a plan of a few rooms of these houses. In fact, I think only one house has more rooms, but there are stairs up so they can get out of those single rooms. And in each of these rooms, it represents a family, the Gascoignes, the Lamberts and the Holroyds, and each of those families are playing out a particular play. So in the case of the Gascoignes, the play that is being done is the daughter-in-law. In the case of the Lamberts, they are doing a play called Colley's Friday Night, and in case of the Holroyds, it is The Widowing of Mrs. Holroyd. The Widowing of Mrs. Holroyd rather gives away the end of the play, and perhaps the end of all three plays. The idea is that these plays are being played out concurrently. This has slight difficulties in terms of the originals. The original Collier's Friday Night is, as the title suggests, on one Friday evening, where an educated young man comes back to his family and feels above them and also feels alienated from his family. It's almost a lost cause with his father, but it's also the alienation with his mother, especially as he's developing a relationship with an educated young woman in a different part of the town. So there is that feeling of alienation there. In The Widowing of Mrs. Holroyd, the play in its original form takes place over a couple of days, or about a week, and we see this woman trapped in an unhappy marriage with a bullying husband coming to start a slight romance with a visiting mining electrician. And then you get The Daughter-in-Law, which takes place on separate nights, but they are split across several weeks, because at one point one of the characters disappears off for a couple of weeks, going to Manchester, I think, in order to spend a lot of money. So it's been rather cleverly put together, this, but what you do lack, I think, is sometimes you lack the cohesion of the individual plays. If you have to sort of spin out a play that takes place in one night so that it appears, because these plays are being synchronised together, so that only one play is happening at the same time, so your concentration is on that particular fragment of the play, and then they move on to the next play, but they're all supposed to be taking place at about the same time. So if you split something like Collier's Friday Night into this sort of suddenly lasting 2 weeks instead of one night, you lose some of the concentration on it. And this is a very well put together piece, and I think it's very cleverly put together, but I had slight problems, which I'll probably come to. The casts, though, are very good. As the Gascoignes, we have Joe Armstrong, Matthew Baker, Susan Brown, Louise Brearley. As the Holroyds, we have Anne-Marie Duff, Martin Marquez, and Philip McGlinley as the mining electrician. And the Lamberts, Mrs. Lambert is Julia Ford, Mr. Lambert, or Walter Lambert, is Lloyd Hutchinson, and Johnny Gibbon is the son, Ernest. And we also have Talia Guleva as Nellie Lambert. I think it's very well put together as a concept. But for me, I think the problem is I have actually seen all three of these plays on their own. So, I mean, it might have been 20 years since I've seen Collier's Friday Night, and Collier's Friday Night is perhaps the weakest of these plays on its own. And in fact, I do remember, because I know Monty Python more than I know D.H. Lawrence, going to Collier's Friday Night and constantly thinking of the phrase tungsten carbide drills, because of a rather famous Monty Python sketch which sort of parodied D.H. Lawrence. And it kind of ruined for me that production. But that production, you know, had some good people in it. I mean, all 20 years ago, but we do have people like Dominic Rowan, Kate Ashfield, Sophie Stanton, Barbara Jefford, and Edward Peel in that. And that was quite a strong production. More recently, The Daughter-in-Law, which played at the Young Vic 10 years ago in 2002, which had Paul Hilton, Marjorie Yates, and a certain Anne-Marie Duff, who's obviously in this as well. And that got a lot of attention, and not staggeringly great reviews, but it was good, solid production, and people admired it, I think, rather than thinking it was absolutely fantastic. So it's a sort of three-star kind of show. More recently, we had a very good production at the Orange Tree of The Widowing of Mrs. Holroyd. I mean, last year, in fact. And that starred Ellie Piercy, Jury Sorossi, Polly Hemingway, and Jordan Misford. It was a very good production, very powerful production. There's a great scene at the end, the washing of the body, which was extremely emotional. And because I kind of knew all these plays and was familiar with them, I kept missing bits. I kept noticing that they had to cut things out, and they want to make the plays in some way talk to each other. So they do occasionally, you get these extra lines where they mention each other, or they hear an argument in the rather closely spaced houses. Although it has to be said that you do feel that they're slightly, in terms of class, even within the working class, they are a slightly different level of wealth in each of the houses. The Gascoignes are perhaps the richest, and then it goes down to the Holroyds. So you do get this talking to each other, but what I missed was some of the power. I mean, as I said, Collier's Friday Night can be easily satirised, and you can see the fun in it. But there is still a little bit of power, and especially you do occasionally see fragments of it when you have Julia Ford as the mother confronting her son and trying to come to terms with him abandoning her. And there's an awful lot of this. I mean, although it's the place called Husbands and Sons, of course, it's really to do with these three strong women, Mrs. Gascoigne and Mrs. Lambert and Mrs. Holroyd, who are trying to cope with various levels of wayward husband or wayward son like that. So it does work in those terms as to look at that. But I couldn't help feeling that I'd much rather have seen the whole, certainly in the case of the daughter-in-law and the widowing of Mrs. Holroyd, I would much rather have seen that cast doing the whole play in each case. I would happily have watched those two plays, even back to back, even if it took 5 hours. The play this itself takes three hours, and they've probably most heavily cut the Collier's Friday Night. And again, I would love to have seen Julia Ford giving us the whole play. It's a very well cast evening, but I couldn't help feeling that I was missing out. I was missing out on, certainly on two very good plays, and what looked like it could be a very good production of The Collier's Friday Night. And, yes, the word gutted came to mind. You know, I felt that the place had actually been almost gutted, and it sort of too much had been taken out of them individually to make it a really great evening for me. But it's probably just because I have seen all these plays, I am familiar with them, and I have an affection for each of the productions that I've seen in the past. Nick, what did you think about this?
I haven't seen them individually, and I don't particularly miss not having seen them individually, because I'm not a huge fan of D.H. Lawrence. I mean, as I understand it, I think people where he came from were not massive fans of D.H. Lawrence either, because, you know, he is kind of an early creator of misery porn that kind of sucks the joy out of life, and it's like, yes, these people are poor and they have there's no kind of light and shade in their lives. It's just utter misery. So I'm not, you know, I'm not particularly gutted to have not seen the shows individually. I probably, you know, depending on the cast, I probably would when they do eventually get staged again. But I mean, for me, what was successful about the evening was the new format that's been created in both. I mean, I've not always been convinced by some of Ben Power's work, but this is very, very strong for me in terms of creating a single work. And Marianne Elliott as well is such a kind of, she's a director with a very kind of strong hand that you feel like she knows exactly what she wants to do, and she does it. And she's also somebody who, I think, looking around the cast, you see people a lot kind of recurring in her work. She kind of has people she works with over and over, not to the extent of kind of excluding new people, but she does kind of work with actors' strengths and kind of promotes people who've been good in kind of smaller roles in other things. I think originally Johnny Gibbon was one of the standbys for Christopher in The Curious Incident, and now she's brought him back to the National for a central role. Matthew Barker has been in small roles in quite a lot of her shows and now gets something a bit more central to do. So she is one of these people you kind of feel a certain amount of loyalty between her and her actors. And it is nice to kind of see these casts following around, and really, I think it does make for some very strong performances, and it does make a very cohesive whole. I think, I don't know whether I necessarily call Buddy Chris's set very simple. I mean, it does strip things down, you know, you're not going to see a detailed house, and I must say I don't get exactly what the distinction is for what is a physical prop and what gets mimed. There's some invisible line between what, you know, there's certain things you can understand, like coat hooks, because they obviously don't have walls to hang them on, but then certain items, you know, they'll have water, but they won't have tea. Tea will be mimed, but there'll be actual water. So sort of it's a bit weird in trying to figure out what the logic is there, which is a bit distracting. But yeah, for me, I liked the kind of the overall community that is sort of built here, and the idea that you've got high drama going on in one house, but that it's not isolated, it's not a unique thing.
you know, while something's going on in your house that's taking up all your attention, everybody, you know, the other sides of the walls has got their own huge to them issues. So I liked it a lot more than I should that much, D.H. Lawrence, and I think it does come down to the way it's been put together, the way it's been rewritten and staged and acted. It's a really strong cast. Like I say, it's been kind of put together from a variety of kind of better known names like Anne-Marie Duff, and then you've got, you know, the people that Marion Elliott has experience with and can trust. And you've got a really strong overall picture. And like I say, it's not something to go for a nice light evening out, and you kind of come out going, well, I wouldn't want to sit through that again anytime soon, but it is strong for me.
Before we start this review, it looks like my microphone was not properly connected, so my sound quality is a bit bad. Sorry about that. We're now going to talk about Platts and Tangles, which is a new play by Nicola Wilson, upstairs at the Royal Court. It's directed by Lucy Morrison and has a cast that includes Monica Dolan, Breech Brennan, Ferdy Roberts, Rosalind Eleazar, Alice Felgate, Robert Lonsdale, Ted Riley, and Vanessa Babier. It concerns a woman called Megan who discovers early in a relationship, in fact, when she's expecting, just before her wedding, she discovers that she has a 50-50 chance of developing early onset Alzheimer's. When she gets pregnant, she is offered a genetic test, and the play deals with the questions of what she should do about this and what she decides to do about this. We see the character Megan several times in her 20s, where she's played by Rosalind Eleazar, and in her 30s and 40s, going beyond that, where she's played by Monica Dolan. And when she's played by Monica Dolan, we begin to see that this possibly a successful, intelligent woman is slowly succumbing to Alzheimer's. And it works, and it's quite a powerful play that jumps around a lot. Julie, tell me more about this and what you thought of it.
Yeah, I mean, I think it took me a while to kind of get into the narrative because it, as you say, it jumps around a lot. The story actually starts right in the middle, and then you seem to go backwards in time. And there are other moments in the play where that happens, where there's moments where they're going backwards in the scene and then flashbacks to what happened early on. So it's up to you watching to piece all this together and work out what's actually going on and who's who. I think it is successful overall. I think there were just bits where I got a little bit confused. I think I got confused with her mother, because we were actually flashing back to scenes with her mother. This was her figmentation of her mother. But the dilemma of what do you do if you know there's a possibility of having this gene, and finding out, preparing, and not knowing, or not having the test, not knowing. And I think it's horrendous, whatever choice you make, because there's always that hanging over you, and finding out that you haven't got this gene. But it's the risk that you take, because if you have got the gene, then it's always going to be hanging over you. That idea that you prepare for it, it's just unthinkable. I actually found the ending, or the last 20 minutes, the most satisfying of the whole thing, in terms of really moving me and seeing this woman and her downfall. It was just exhilarating, the end of it. And I just thought sometimes the start of the play just took too long to get to that point. I thought there were some great performances. Ferdy Roberts and Monica Dolan were fantastic performances. The other thing that I found annoying at times was the moving the set around. The actors always moving the set around, and I didn't think that was necessary, actually. I think it could have worked with a static set. But there was this intriguing kind of lights above the stage that kept flashing that were to resemble the brain, and this idea that memory's fragmented and it doesn't work chronologically, and the play was trying to do that as well. And I thought that for me was really, really interesting. I don't know what you thought, Tim.
I'm a bit of a fan of Monica Dolan. I once told people that she would be the next big thing, which was perhaps a little bit of a mistake, but she is a very, very fine actress and deserves to be known more, I think. So I was very impressed, certainly, by her performance and by the writing as a whole. Although it does have this kind of confusing structure, it's kind of what you expect upstairs at the Royal Court. It's something which is a little bit off the wall, a little bit confusing. You know, it explains a lot of things about Alzheimer's. It's a very frightening disease to see, you know, people just disappearing, which is what happens here, and happens early, and happens when you're young enough to think that it's not something that ought to happen. The Placid Tangles of the title are the idea of what an Alzheimer's brain looks like once they analyse it. It refers to sort of brain structures, you know, the plaques and the tangles, the brain structure, these structures that seem to develop within the brain, and cause people to die. But it's I keep coming back to the word impressive. I don't want to, but there is that. It's cleverly done. It's well put together, and it does seem to be done by somebody, Nicola Wilson. I'm not sure whether or not she has a background in this, but she certainly seems to. It seems to come, if not from the heart, certainly from a lot of knowledge of it. I mean, perhaps that doesn't quite have the heart of. You know, it's not absolutely heartfelt, but then again, when you're dealing with somebody who doesn't remember anything, it can be very difficult, other than witnessing it. You can't really get into their mind, because their mind is gradually going. It's certainly a sad thing to watch, and it gave me an increased knowledge of this, and you felt that you were... It's one of those things that sometimes happens in the theatre. You know, you are increasing your knowledge of something, and you can't say that you're necessarily having a good time, but you're certainly having, you certainly think it's worthwhile seeing it. And it's, I think, well put together, for all its slightly messed up chronology. But I suppose that's part of the point, you know.
Yeah, I agree with that. I'm sure the playwright Nicola Wilson has a lot of knowledge, not just of the science, but emotionally, because that was really striking in the play and the effects on the rest of the family.
You can find us at AYULTP on Twitter, on the as yet unnamed London Theatre Podcast page on Facebook, on the web we are AYULTP.com. The podcast can also be found on both iTunes and Stitcher, where you can leave a review. Thank you. Goodbye.